Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We're presented by CLNS Media. Today on the show, Dieter Kurtenbach is back. Dieter Kurtenbach has a head cold.
Sorry. I mean, I apologize for, first off, I generally apologize to most people who have to listen to my voice anyway, but right now it's in all sorts of raspiness. It's not great, but I think my head's clear. So Sam, I think that we need to dive immediately into basketball ratings, because if there's one thing I've proven to be an expert on, it's basketball ratings. Jesus Christ.
I love. See, the problem is that you and I both love that topic so much. Like, me because I worked, like,
right,
in that industry, and you because you're just a weirdo.
I'm like, a fucking weirdo. That is 100% the accurate representation of why I love it. And the problem is, anytime we talk about it, you are actually, like, deeply knowledgeable, where I'm coming from this, like, weird populist stance. And mostly like an anti-Adam Silver stance. And so it's just like emotions versus reason. And I hate being on the wrong side of that argument. So let's not talk about that, in fact, even though the ratings were down big time. And I understand that Canada's part of it. I totally understand. But Canada didn't give out a major $28, $27 billion TV deal or whatever the hell it was.
Yeah, but they gave out like some sort of TV deal for TSN and Sportsnet to get it.
I don't know what Sportsnet deal is. I'll ask around on that, actually. That would be an interesting number to find out.
Yeah, because I actually was tweeting back and forth with the Paulson guy and then with Sam Esfandiari and a couple other people. And I was like, yeah, like the number that actually matters here is that. Like, it depends on what they're getting, like, on a per season and per game basis from TSN and how that compares to the audience share that they're getting. So,
right.
Like, yeah, I think that you'd need to know those numbers to, like, actually be able to do this, and nobody really contextualizes it as such. So,
No, well, but mind you, the base information is coming off of an ESPN tweet, which included in the tweet Canada numbers not included. So, like, they were already in super spin mode to start, which I thought was fairly telling. But alas, I thought it was a fantastic game of basketball that everyone should have watched. I really enjoyed it.
It was a great game. It was such a fun game to watch. The Raptors won, obviously. I believe they won 118 to 109. Was that the final?
Yes, sir. Yes, it is.
So where do you want to start? You were there. I mean, I'll just give you the floor on this one.
Okay. Well, I mean, let's do our requisite media member loves Toronto segment here, which I'm sure everyone is doing across the nation right now. I'll try to keep mine short. Toronto is awesome. That was as fun of an atmosphere
Hot take. Yeah. I've never been to Toronto.
Oh, you must. You must. Now, I would not recommend it for 9 months out of the year. But, like, starting now, pretty good time to show up in Toronto. End of May through about August. Yeah, that maybe even September. This is a world-class city. I know this is turning almost into a trope, how many Americans want to be like, oh, Toronto's fantastic. I've been here enough to know kind of what Toronto's about. But I was really looking forward to really getting it. We're here for a week. And, you know, with the days off in between, and certainly with the 2 days before the finals, where it's like, we've run out of things to say. Like, I got nothing to write here, so I might as well go, you know, eat ramen or something, or poutine. Like, I was really looking forward to sinking my teeth into this bad boy. Then this goddamn head cold showed up. But nevertheless, I was taken back by, you know, you hear, I never covered a game or a Raptors game. I've covered Maple Leafs game, but I never covered a Raptors game in Toronto. I was taken back by the fact that I walked into the Arena Bowl with about 12 minutes to go before the first tip, which is pretty early for me and usually pretty early for the fans. There was not a single goddamn seat empty. And that's not hyperbole. And it is a massive arena. It holds just shy of 20K. It is reminiscent of like the United Center in Chicago in terms of just its sheer scale and the amount of people that are kind of stacked in there. And the rendition of O Canada was like chillingly cool. They were loud from the start and they didn't let up. And that was a factor in the game. I don't know how much of a factor, but it was absolutely a factor. Like this entire series is just going to be fucking awesome when it comes to in arena atmosphere, because we know what Oracle Arena brings, even in this sort of late stage of Oracle Arena with the fleece vests. But at Toronto, brought the noise. They're going to bring it again in game two for sure. Warriors fans are going to bring it in three and four and possibly six. It's going to be fucking awesome to cover this in person. So I just, you know, hashtag blessed to be here with that. But in terms of the game, when Pascal Siakam, who is first team all Dieter, I love Pascal Siakam. I don't know how anyone couldn't love Pascal Siakam, so it's not like I'm unique in that sense. When he drops 32 on 14 of 17 shooting on your ass, you're not going to win the game if you're the Golden State Warriors. And if the Raptors had somehow lost that game and squandered the best offensive performance against the Warriors, I would argue, statistically in terms of shooting percentage and stuff, it is the best percentage that the Warriors have given up in the entire Steve Kerr era, playoffs or regular season. If you were to squander a game like that, the series would have felt over. And instead, it feels like we got what we more or less expected in terms of it was always going to be tight. This is the Warriors offense and the strength of that offense without Kevin Durant, which is all, you know, perimeter, to the point where they started Jordan Bell at the five in game one. Going up against the Raptors' strength, which is perimeter defense with Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard, and Pascal Siakam just putting the clamps on dudes, and Kyle Lowry, we should say, as well. It was always going to be a cagey series, I thought. It was always going to be a fascinating little chess match. I think the Warriors figured some stuff out once they finally, I don't know, engaged in the goddamn game. But the Raptors have always been really good and a worthy adversary, and this series always had six or seven sort of slated on it. And I think that that's kind of where we're at. The Raptors brought their A game. It's on the Warriors to make some adjustments. But even if they make the right adjustments, I don't think that there's any blowouts in this series one way or another.
No, I think that I would agree with you on that. It's funny. So, you know, the big like thing that I think happened in this game, like let's start with Golden State's defense. Because
or lack thereof.
Well, yeah, early on, it was just an abject mess, I thought, on defense from the Warriors. You know what the like kind of funny thing is about this, though? Raptors actually scored at a better point per possession clip in the second half than they did in the first half.
Yeah. Well, because they kept shooting threes early in the first quarter, and it's like the Warriors were totally fine with that. As bad as their defense was and as many times as the rotations completely broke down,
right.
I think the Warriors were totally content with, like, and this is what I was kind of getting at with the Pascal Siakam thing. Pascal Siakam shot 26% regular season and postseason combined on above-the-break threes. Like, this is a guy who just developed a three-point shot, and he has hung out in the corners all year in order to make that shot viable for him, and that makes a lot of sense when you consider how do you develop a three-pointer. The Warriors, absolutely part of the game plan is, if Pascal Siakam wants to take an above-the-break three, we will live with that all day, every day, because he's not efficient at it. Well, he went 2-for-2 on him. And I know two, you know, three-pointers isn't everything, but they're totally cool with letting Marc Gasol take six three-pointers in the game. When he makes four of them, you're like, well, shit. I mean, there it is. It was kind of one of those nights for the Raptors, especially you think like the Fred VanVleet shot late against the shot clock after the Warriors finally figured out trap. Like there was some positive magic vibes happening, but still, like, the Warriors defense wasn't in a position to really shut down anything all night.
Like, here's what I will say. I do think that it is a particularly bad strategy for the Warriors to leave Marc Gasol open from three.
Yeah, he's a good three-point shooter.
Like, he will make 40% of those shots. If he is wide open, he probably will make 45% of those shots, I think. I don't think that is a viable strategy for the Warriors. Part of what the Warriors' identity on defense has been in the Steve Kerr era is they essentially want to force you, and like, look, this is obviously what defenses in general want to do, but they particularly want to force you into doing what you don't want to do, and they're willing to sell out to the nth degree to do so. They are, like, they're not going to guard Tony Allen in the corner from three.
Correct.
There were, for instance, like instances last night where some of it was miscommunication, but other times, like, it was very clear that part of their strategy was, I remember specifically there was a like semi-transition three where Alphonso McKinney stunted toward Pascal Siakam instead of closing out on him and then flew out to the corner to guard the corner three-point shooter. Like, the reason that you stun out there is because, you know, you're relatively comfortable where, hey, if he decides to take this, like, we're comfortable with it at the end of the day. So it's clear that the Warriors are sticking to their strategy of, hey, we want you to take the shots we want you to take, even if they are, you know, Pascal Siakam threes, which to me, like, that's not a disaster shot.
No, especially considering his ability to put the ball on the floor and get to the basket. I mean, if the three is not going, he can still create. And this is something that the Warriors should know plenty about because they've had an entire offense built on that with Draymond Green and Andre Iguodala, whose shot is completely lost, by the way, with the, both of those guys still being able to create offense despite not having good three-point shots. This is something that the Warriors, that you're 100% right on that analysis, because this is something that the Warriors have really trained for every year because they're going to face James Harden in the playoffs. They know they're going to face James Harden in the playoffs. And you think about Game 6 of this year's Western Conference semifinals. You think about Game 7 of last year's Western Conference finals. That's the strategy. We're not going to let the main guy beat us. And if he does beat us, fine. Like, let everyone else deal with it. And they're probably going to miss 27 threes. Maybe that was a bad confirmation bias on them, and they're reading too much into luck. And maybe the flip of that is being, you know, put into play right here with the Raptors, where they knocked down damn near everything that they had a chance to knock down. But yeah, the Warriors are not, it's very clear that the Warriors are not going to let Kawhi Leonard beat them. And I think that after game one, there's a certain, I don't know, concession that we can all make that Kawhi Leonard isn't all with us, that we're not getting, we're certainly not getting 100%, and we're getting a fairly hobbled Kawhi Leonard. I mean, he was like alternating limps last night. And so if the Warriors keep double teaming him, he's a smart player. I don't know if he's the best passer out of those double teams, but he's so cool and calm and collected, I think he'll usually make the right play. But I think that that's what the Warriors want to do, that they don't feel like they can beat a Raptors team where Kawhi Leonard is really operating and really controlling things. So he won't, they're going to put the onus on other dudes to control the game. And last night they absolutely did it. And they could do it again three times. There's no question in my mind that they could. I just don't necessarily think that the Warriors' defense is going to be this shitty going forward, because it was as much as Steve Kerr didn't want to say it, like, the players were totally fine in admitting that they were super rusty after 9 days off. I don't know how much credence you want to give that, but like, it can't not be a thing at the same time. And as you saw them kind of get better and better as the game went along, it only strengthens that argument. And now they have some game film where, I don't know, I don't know what kind of adjustments the Raptors can make. I don't know if they want to make too many of them. They played a really good game in game one, but like, I don't know what the second kind of smoke, the third kind of smoke the Raptors have is. They were already kind of one track coming into this series, and I thought that they put it all together in a nice way, whereas the Warriors have like so many levels they can get to beyond what they showed last night. And frankly, the Raptors should have blown the fucking front doors off of the Warriors with the way that they were playing compared to the way the Warriors were playing, and yet Golden State was always just sort of kind of there in this game, and I have to read into that a little bit. I feel like there's some truth in the margins.
So I'm a lot more worried about Golden State's defense than you are.
I would honestly love to hear why. I'm not disagreeing. I'm just really curious as to why.
So in their last 10 games in the playoffs, so what, games 2 through 6 in the Houston series, and then games 1 through 4 in the Blazer series and last night.
Right.
They've given up a 111 defensive rating. So, like, even in games where they have been, you know, successful at the end of the day.
Right.
I mean, they've lost, what, three of those games and won, let's say, seven of those games, right?
Right.
They're still not really getting stops at the level at which, like, we've seen the Warriors get stops before. Part of that is just, hey, like, this defensive strategy, it didn't work last night because the Raptors guys that they wanted to shoot made shots. Fred VanVleet was ridiculous last night. Like, Pascal was ridiculous last night. Having said that, like, I do think that they're going to want to stop leaving Pascal open. Just straight up. Like, you can't leave Pascal that open. Because the problem is that if he gets downhill, that's an even bigger problem for you. Like, if you just don't close...
He's such a good passer,
Like, if you don't close out on him, you're going to be... You're just allowing him to get downhill. It's kind of like what happens with, like, Giannis, in a way, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you have to play... Giannis has his own sense of gravity because you have to play him at least, like, 17 or 18 feet. Otherwise, he's just going to become a freight train. And it's
He's not pulling up, but if you give him that much runway, he's going to take off.
Right, and I think the Warriors did a poor job last night of giving Pascal too much runway. The second reason...
They also just lost him. Like, Nick Nurse, credit to him. Like, Nick Nurse just slid... The Warriors were hedging off of him when they put him in the corner, so Nick Nurse put him at the dunker spot, and all he had to do was go back and forth from the left block to the right block, and that fucked up everything for the Warriors. Now, I think you can make an adjustment off of that, but, like, that's good coaching.
Well, I think that there's this aspect of it, too. Early in the game, they did a great job of getting Stephen Curry switched on to Pascal. So I thought coming into the series, they would try and get Curry switched on to Kawhi as much as possible. Instead, what they did was they used the 1-4 screen and roll instead of the 1-5 screen and roll early with Marc Gasol. And they used it to get the switch with Pascal, assuming that the Warriors would just be switching every action 1-4, which I think is a reasonable assessment, a reasonable thing to think coming into a series. And Pascal did his job. He did his work on Steph early. And I think that got him going. He didn't really, in the second half, Pascal's points were more, hey, they got out on the break. Hey, dunker spot, just kind of sit him there because they're playing so far off them. Like, this was an awesome game by Nick Nurse. This was a fantastic chess match performance by Nick Nurse, I thought, because just every little button he pushed, despite the fact that he only got a 5-for-14 game from Kawhi Leonard. I mean, like, if Kawhi shoots 35% again in this series, like, I would be surprised, to be honest.
Right.
Now,
oh, really? You think that it's going to increase? Because I
do, and I'll give you another reason why. The Andre Iguodala, like, pull up last night at the end of the game scares me significantly. That is probably the number one thing now that I am most worried about, because, like, I just mentioned Golden State's defense being a concern, and it is. That defense only gets worse if you don't have Andre Iguodala hounding Kawhi Leonard all over the court.
100%. Now, I'll say this about the 111 defensive rating. You're right. It hasn't been great. But you think back to that Blazers series in the Western Conference Finals. That was very regular season-esque from the Warriors, in the sense of they dicked around for 30 minutes and then turned it on for 10 to 15, just because, I guess we got to go now. And we've seen that so many times from this team. And when they decided to just turn it on, it's stupefying. And that's Draymond Green at the center of all of that. And frankly, I didn't feel like Draymond made much of a defensive impact last night, and certainly not comparable to the ways that he had made it in the last two rounds. So I don't disagree that the Warriors' defense isn't as good as maybe we chalk it up to be, certainly on a 48-minute scale. But, man, I've just seen some things, and I refuse to forget that when the Warriors really decide to put on the clamps, it's something special. Now, that said, Toronto's defense is really fucking good, and the Warriors are going to have a lot of problems. There are a lot of lineups out there where it's just like, you better hope Steph gets the ball.
That's the thing that's, like, kind of concerning to me, is, like, they played a bunch of lineups where it was like Steph in the bench or Clay in the bench, and, like, people are throwing
work.
Yeah, like people are throwing out this number that like Steph was 0 for the game whenever he was guarded by Fred VanVleet. And look, Fred's really good and like a particularly good Stephen Curry defender, if only because he really fights through screens really well. Like, I'm not saying that he's like a Stephen Curry stopper or anything, but like marginal level, like compared to other guys, I think he is like
he tries.
Yeah, like he's pretty good.
Really
at this.
Part of this thing. Yeah,
but like. Most of the time when Fred was guarding Steph, it was that like Steph versus, you know, Stephen, no one else in the lineup, and it's 1-on-5, and they're just sagging way off and helping out Fred to like really just force the ball out of Steph's hands. So it's interesting because I think on some level we can look at DeMarcus Cousins as something the Warriors need in this series.
Yes.
But also something that significantly hinders them. Because his passing last night was exceptional. He was unreal as a passer last night. He played like 8 minutes, I think, something like that.
Yeah, 8 minutes.
He created, I would bet you, 6 like potential assists.
Yeah, he only got 2, but he did. He every time he touched the ball and passed it, it seemed like it's a little bit of magic was happening. And at the same time, he pretty much gave up points all but one time on the defensive end. I mean, the Raptors were just foaming at the mouth thinking about attacking him in pick and roll, and they took advantage time and time again there. I mean, it's not the worst thing in the world to be a net zero player. It's just a rarity to be a net zero player when sort of baskets are being scored at both ends and it turns into sort of like a Big 12 football game.
Well, the weird thing with DeMarcus last night was I actually thought he did okay holding up in like pick and roll. They didn't take advantage of him as much as I thought they should have. They only ran, you know, maybe a few actions at him that I saw in the 8 minutes. Like they didn't go wild.
Like they figured it out just, late. Like,
right
then there. Yeah.
That's a good point.
That's
in the fourth quarter. They did in the fourth quarter. Yeah. They did it. But like in the first half, they really only did it, I think, once that I counted.
I'm not looking at the film.
But like in the fourth quarter, they went at it a little bit more. But the bigger problem for me was the transition defense when he was on the floor.
He can't move.
Like they're playing 4-on-5 for way too long, I think. And that's a significant issue.
Especially when you're going up against a unit that features no viable ball handlers. I like Quinn Cook, but like that's not the dude. He's not built for this post, you know, this postseason life. And
well, like Quinn is good at,
and they want Quinn off ball because he can space the floor, and that's something that they actually lack. So what happens is it's
Boogie. And like he can like fight over screens and guard a little bit against guys like Fred.
He's an NBA player, but that's as far as I'm willing to go. And he'll knock down an open three, which is he did it last night, and it's something that's really found money for the Warriors. And frankly, with this bench, like, beggars can't be choosers, but you're getting a lot of dribbling from Clay, and you're getting a lot of dribbling from DeMarcus, which means you're probably going to get a higher percentage of turnovers. I don't have the number in front of me, but the Raptors have to feel good about their ability to turn defense into offense, and that's something that the Warriors have kind of made famous, and obviously they didn't invent it or anything, but that's a lot of their ethos is centered around that notion. They were really unable to do it last night, and the Raptors, who they've done it all year long at a hyper-elite level, really showed what they were made of in that regard. And the Warriors' transition defense was absolute dog shit. And that just take Cousins out of the equation, because no one would have expected Cousins, even if he was 100% healthy, to be good in transition defense, much less when he can barely get up and down the floor because he's so out of shape after taking like 9 weeks off. And we, us big men, take away our cardio for a while. It's rough going. It's just a true statement. Watching it back, Steve Kerr just kind of went in on it after the game. It was fairly obvious during the game, but it was like, it was comical. It was regular season bullshit that the Warriors were pulling off when it came to transition defense. I mean, they had no fucking idea where the ball was, where the cutters were. The Raptors just absolutely smoked them. And it's like, this is why I don't know if Kerr gets paid the big bucks. I think he's a really good X's and O's coach. That doesn't really shine through very often because the team's so goddamn talented. And oftentimes, like, the good X's and O's play is like, hey, let's give Kevin the ball more. But, like, man, the adjustments that he can make on the fly with certain stuff is just really, really impressive. Nevertheless, I can't imagine how many fucking times he brought up in the lead up to game one, transition defense, transition defense, transition defense. Like, if we can slow down the Raptors in transition, then we get to sort of dictate the pace of the game, because we know what they do in the half court. We feel really comfortable with our strategy defensively on Kawhi in the half court. You feel good about it. But if they can get out and run, which means that, one, we're turning the ball over more than we should, and two, we're not getting back on defense, like, then we're fucked. That's an entire other game that we're losing. And if you lose both of those games, or even if you only lose one of them, like, the margins are such to where you're probably not going to win. I can't imagine how many times he pounded home transition defense, and then for the Warriors to just play just laughable transition defense for the entire game. Like, maybe that's why they pay him as much as he does. Like, I don't know, how does he reach these kids? Like, I don't get it.
How do I reach these kids?
Exactly. That's all I could think about walking home or walking back to the courtyard last night. It was like I would just be pulling my fucking hair out, where it's like, rule number one of playing the Toronto Raptors, as Kerr said, is stop their transition offense. And I know that you can't stop transition offense all the time, but, like, I don't know, half an ounce of hustle usually goes a pretty good way on the defensive side. And, like, the Warriors just were, it's like they had never seen a fast break before at times. It was just, it was laughable. So
that part of it was laughable. I will say this. I
think that they get better at that, right? Like, or am I just too optimistic? Am I too close to the sun here?
So they have to get better at transition defense. Like, that is, I think, their number one issue. The number two thing that happened that was very weird in this game.
Yeah.
You look at contested field goal percentage for Toronto.
Oh, I haven't seen this. Let me know.
So Toronto shot 45 uncontested shots versus 32 contested shots, which is just kind of not good enough on some.
No. That's a bad ratio for the Warriors. Usually they're around 50-50, if not a little bit better.
Right. But here's the thing. Toronto shot 42.2% on the uncontested shots and 62.5%.
Yeah.
On contested field goal attempts.
That's what I was talking about. Like, that level of magic that they had going on. Where, like, listen, you could see it in Steph Curry's face. I think there was maybe 3 minutes left, maybe even two in the fourth quarter. And the Warriors were down 10. The game was probably over. But it was one of those things where it's the Warriors, so you never really quite count them out. And it felt like Golden State was starting to figure some stuff out. And they were throwing traps at Kawhi. And Kawhi throws it over to Van Vliet, and Van Vliet takes a step back dribble forward long two that hit the rim more times than Kawhi shot against the Sixers, and, like, hit the inside of, like, it almost wedgied, and then, like, rolls in the wrong way. And Steph, the ball falls right in front of Steph as it goes through the hoop, and you could just tell he just went, not tonight. It's just not happening. Like, sometimes the other team just has the magic touch. The Warriors have certainly gotten it far more often than they've been the victim of it. That's what I'm talking about with some of that stuff. Like, I love Fred. I think that he's a really good player. He's been awesome over the last few games. If he could do it three more times, congratulations to Toronto for winning a title. Like, I think that that's where the Warriors have to be.
So, yeah, the Fred Van Vliet shot. So I was watching the game with Laura in our living room, and that shot was, like, the only time that made Laura, like, sit up and go, wow! Like, she was, like, half, like, paying attention to, like, the netball international rosters that just got released, like, half paying attention to, like, dog videos on Facebook. And
this is an all-time sentence. All-time sentence. Netball and dog videos.
Yeah, and, like, and that Van shot, that Fred Van Vliet shot is the one that made her go, wow, whoa! Like, yeah. Just unbelievable that shot went in.
It's not to say he didn't earn it. Like, he worked his ass off.
No, Fred was great last night. Fred was genuinely great last night.
I don't think the Warriors totally expected Fred to, like, continue to stay on his bullshit in this game. Like, I think that kind of...
Fred is a tough dude. I would not bet against that guy.
No. I'm not betting against him. But, like, at a certain point, like, how long is he in Fuego? And he was so awesome at the end of the Eastern Conference Finals, and so you just think to yourself, like, well, maybe he'll look like Fred Van Vliet again. And yet he didn't. And so now I guess you just can't you can't take for granted that he's, you know, it's going to turn back into a pumpkin or whatever.
Yeah.
He's here.
No, Fred's good.
No question.
Let's see. Let's talk about the Kevin Durant of it all.
Okay.
So one thing that I said coming in was Kevin Durant is going to play a bigger, like Kevin Durant against the Raptors is a bigger deal than having Kevin Durant against other similarly talented teams to the Raptors because of the way that the matchups trickle down, right?
Right.
Like Pascal Siakam doesn't go for 32 if Kevin Durant is on the
No. Yeah. Because you have more freedom to mix and match. You can throw Draymond in certain spots, or you can just put Draymond on Pascal and trust that Kevin can protect the rim a little bit better. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Right. Well, you can do either, right? Like, or right. You can just like play softer, like, and like, look, the Warriors probably won't do this, but like they could play like a softer shell, like defense, similar to what the Raptors did against the Bucks. And
you're
say,
saying
like,
go to the zone?
It's not really a zone. It's like just a heavy help, like man to man scheme. But like,
yeah, it's but like they didn't want to do it last night in helping off of the weak side. They would do it off of Siakam, but they really didn't want to do it for anybody else. And
so there's just a lot more to do, basically. Like there are a lot more options on defense if you have Kevin, and then additionally on offense you have another guy to help. Like just with depth as much as anything, like look, Kevin Durant is Kevin fucking Durant. He's a lot more than depth, but like it just allows you to not have to play like 10 guys in the first quarter. Seriously, the Warriors played 11 players last night and like none of them were even Andrew Bogut. Like it was weird.
Well, no, it wasn't weird. I mean, this is the kumbaya cur that Nate Duncan so likes to talk about, but like they started Jordan Bell at center. Let's just say, if Kevin Durant's in this series, I don't think that anyone's hand-wringing about the Warriors' chances. They probably don't lose game one. Like, I'm happy to get into
I agree with the, you. The, like, I think this is no question a series win if Kevin Durant plays for the Warriors.
Right. Like, it's like
every game that is.
Right. But I'm wondering, like, okay, the Bell thing, I understand why they did it. It did not work necessarily, but it wasn't like a laughable move for Kerr to start Bell, because you're essentially saying, okay, yeah, we're a perimeter-based team without Kevin Durant, because we're not going to give the ball to a guy on the block and let him sort of ISO up against us.
I'll be very honest. I didn't understand it at all.
Well, it's the alternatives are rough. I think you want... Listen, the correct answer is Kevon Looney in the starting lineup with this Warriors roster. The real correct answer is you have Kevin Durant and you start Draymond at center.
Well, like here's the other thing too. It's not like the Raptors' lead guards are so like explosive and athletic that it's like a significant Andrew Bogut mismatch. You know,
well,
what I mean?
and we very well might see Bogut, especially with the Siakam at the dunker spot situation, to where that now, if they're going to relegate in a certain way Siakam to being a center in the offense or a traditional center in the offense and just hanging out by the basket, the Warriors have the ability now to actually use a true center, in this case Andrew Bogut or perhaps even Damian Jones, in that spot as well. At least on the defensive end, and then they like what Bogut brings to them on the offensive end because he's such a nice passer as well. And we saw the value of what Cousins was able to do as a passer. Maybe that with Bogut, you can tap into some of that magic. So I wouldn't be shocked at all if Bogut starts Game Two if he gets a decent run, not significant, but a decent run because
he plays like 15 minutes.
Yeah, and that's pretty much his limit. Like as much as he is coming off of a season in Australia and stuff, like he looked gassed at times in an up and down series against the Blazers.
For people who are unaware, like the NBL is a very half court based league, half court based,
which is why he dominated. But I can absolutely with the Durant thing. If Durant's in here, it totally changes stuff. So much of this fun little Warriors run that I guess came to an end last night, but this whimsical, nostalgia-filled, we're throwing it back to 2015 moments.
They're 31-1 in the last 32 games that Stephen Curry has played and Kevin Durant hasn't.
Fucking A, they beat the Grizzlies in February. Let's fucking raise a banner for that shit. Like, I do find it absolutely fascinating. There's a goddamn reason they brought in Kevin fucking Durant, and it's because the Warriors. I have been watching to the point of insanity. Like, I feel like everything in my life now just revolves around the final three games of the 2016 NBA Finals. It's all I think about, because it just feels like we're having to relitigate that moment where Draymond Green goes to the parking lot and calls Kevin Durant and says, "We need you." And the Warriors know that that beautiful kind of smoke that they had, the high motion offense, the Steph Curry, Draymond Green pick and roll, and the super switching defense, that it would not stay at the top. That as the revolutionaries of the league in so many ways, and just as much as everyone sort of has copied the Warriors and now taken it levels beyond that on the offensive end, we're seeing every team in the league, or at least the competent ones, switch almost everything on defense. That shit was not happening before Draymond Green got slid in to the starting lineup for the Golden State Warriors. Yes, teams would switch, but not to the level the Warriors did, and not with the aplomb that the Warriors did it. And, right. And now that is the only way to play defense in this NBA.
I strongly disagree with that, for what it's worth. Like, we saw the Raptors like do the exact opposite of that last series. Right.
Last series, but not last night.
No, you can't really do it against the Warriors. Like, you can't play that soft shell against the Warriors.
They switched plenty. They switched plenty against the Bucks. Now, they also had...
Sure.
My point is, switching is not a novelty in any way, shape, or form. It's the norm. If you cannot switch, you are dead in the modern NBA.
On some level, you have to switch, for sure.
And Pascal Siakam is the perfect example of, like, the modern NBA. Not just the backstory and all that stuff, but just you think about what he is as a four in this league and what he would have been even before Draymond Green. I mean, a tweener is probably not the right way to put it. They might have put him at the two. Like, I don't even know what you do with a Pascal Siakam in a league where switching isn't ubiquitous. But nevertheless, the Warriors knew after the Cavs, and credit to Ty Lue, they threw it all against the wall. And I don't know why it took them four games to sort of figure it out, but Curry had that knee thing. He wasn't as explosive as he needed to be. We saw that in the Western Conference Finals in 2016, to where he just couldn't pull up from the distance he wanted to pull up from. And Clay kind of had to get them over the hump almost single-handedly. What the Cavs saw in that high pick-and-roll thing was exactly... If you grab and hold and claw and make life just exceedingly difficult off the ball, and you put the right amount of pressure on Curry, and sometimes that means traps, but smart traps, because you don't want the 4-on-3 coming the other way, you can really slow down the perimeter high-motion offense. And that's just switching everything, grabbing and clawing, and being smart about when... You try to take the ball out of the point guard's hands. This is
one thing that I thought was really interesting, though, was the way that the Warriors did an awful lot of blitzing and trapping last night.
Well, I think
with
I think
how good the Raptors are as a passing team, though, like everyone on the court for the Raptors, basically at all times, other than maybe Serge, can really pass the ball. Like,
oh yeah.
Kawhi can pass the ball now. Pascal's a great passer. Gasol's a great passer. Danny Green is not, like, going to create plays for you with, like, driving kicks, but he's great at just reversing the ball around the perimeter. And super, we saw, like, just this unbelievable ball movement from the Raptors last night. A lot of times after the Warriors would decide to trap the ball, sometimes it was to get the ball out of Kawhi's hands. Sometimes it was just to kind of try and wreak havoc, because that's what they do. And they want to, again, try and get the ball in certain hands.
It's a sacrifice to get some pace going in the game, because if Kawhi has the ball, the Raptors are totally content. And this is kind of what I was getting at before I just totally lost anything I had going. This is the Houston Rockets built an entire system around what the Cavaliers did in the final three games of the 2016 NBA Finals, which is hyper-isolation offense, totally control the pace of the game, let superstars go one-on-one against mostly Curry, if we're being honest, or the weakest link at center. Control the pace of the game on that end, and then just kind of do Seattle Seahawks pass interference on every play defense on the other end, and just make it really, really hard for the Warriors to move around and clog stuff up and make them look constipated. When Kevin Durant came in, it got rid of all the predictability for the Warriors offense. And sometimes that didn't look all that great, but just having a dude who you could give the ball to and everyone can get the fuck out of the way and stand and grab their shorts or whatever, and Kevin Durant is going to turn around. It doesn't matter if there's one, two, or three guys in front of him. He can rise up and get you a 15-foot bucket. Like, that changes everything, because now instead of the opposing team grabbing and holding and really clogging stuff up on the perimeter, now they have to throw some attention towards Durant, who's typically sitting sort of in the high post on the block. And, okay, well, if you're going to try to clog up the perimeter and then give it to Durant, Durant, that's just good offense. He's going to get more than a point per possession off of those ISOs. And then, okay, well, now we're going to throw some more bodies there. Well, that opens up the perimeter again. You can go back to the high-motion offense, and it's the fastball. It's the changeup. And the defense is always off balance with this Warriors offense. And right now we're seeing exactly what the Warriors found out in 2016, which is we're kind of predictable right now. And a predictable offense is an offense, especially now, 3 years later, as teams have gotten tape and tape and tape and studied and studied and studied and understand the value of what the Warriors were really doing, it's easy to stop in a lot of cases. And Steph had to hit a bunch of really fucking tough shots. Klay is completely out of his element. And if you're having kind of the Harrison Barnes situation all over again with Andre Iguodala and Draymond Green and Alphonso McKinney, where it's like, yeah, the other team's going to dare those guys to shoot. And if they don't knock down baskets, the Warriors don't really stand much of a chance.
So let's talk about going forward, what happens, and we'll kind of finish on that. This is not going to be a marathon podcast, folks.
As much as I might try.
So what do the Warriors do going forward? Let's assume that they have Andre Iguodala.
Yeah.
Well, let's... I don't think Durant, we can assume Durant's that Kevin's going to come back until four. Like, seriously, people around the NBA that I've talked to are like, this is not a good injury for Kevin Durant to have.
I know. I know as well as the four has always been the number that I've been told. It just makes sense on top of things. The fact that the Warriors haven't been transparent at all about the grade of the injury, it's actually kind of shocking that Kevin's camp hasn't leaked it either, which I guess is telling in and of itself. It's not a good injury. And they're going into this series was very real concern that Kevin would not play at all in these NBA finals. I think that there is an optimism, and it's an honest optimism now, that he will play. But the series might be out of hand by that point if the Warriors don't get their act together on defense. I think that the adjustments that they can make on that end are fairly simple. I think it's an effort thing, first and foremost. Most of transition defense is just, I know the Warriors are smart enough, so it really just comes down to if they want to do it enough, and I'm pretty sure that they should probably fucking try with being down 1-0 in the series. The other adjustments, you have to try to find a way to break through to Klay and tell him he's got to stop taking so many off-balance shots. He's just been off. And last night, there's no question, I think Pascal Siakam was the best player on the court. Curry had a nice game, but Siakam was the best player on the court. What he was able to do defensively is always awesome. And then his offensive game was just through the roof. If he's the third best player, if you got the two established stars in Kawhi and Steph, and those they just have those top two spots, they're grandfathered in because of who they are. And I thought Kawhi, even though he didn't have a great box score game, was really impactful on the game for better and for worse.
I would say 90% for better in Kawhi's case.
Yeah. No. And there were some situations I think the Warriors feel comfortable with saying, like, ooh, okay, we can, let's try to bring out more of that. But nevertheless, if Pascal Siakam's the third best player on the court, or if he's in that that three-man triumvirate, if he's the guy who makes it up, the Warriors are fucked, because it should be Draymond Green. It should be a guy. It should be Klay Thompson. Klay Thompson talked about how he really wanted to make the All-NBA team. I understand his gripe in not making it. I wouldn't have put him on it personally, but I get it. He did have an unbelievable second half of the year. After the 2019 switch, he was just on fire, and it made up for a really woesome first 2018.
Woesome?
2018. I don't know, man. Leave me alone.
Definitely sick.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I made it this far. Like, it was... If he thinks he should be an All-NBA player, I hate to fall into this easy sports talk radio trope, but, like, show the fuck up. Like,
yeah, he was tough last night. He was real bad.
He sucked in the Western Conference Finals. Now, listen, his defense will always make him a passable player. He's really good on defense. And you don't want to take away from that. I have been kind of my mantra this entire postseason is we don't talk about defense enough. We don't talk about defense enough. It matters. And we're getting it. We're getting it with two teams that can be hyper elite. And the Raptors, I think, showed their best stuff last night. And the Warriors still are yet to kind of show theirs. But I know what that level is, and it is awesome. But
by the way, we're like complaining about Clay. Clay went 8 of 17 from the field, 3 of 6, and a lot of it was late. For sure.
A lot of it was like in quasi garbage time. I know that the scoreline doesn't say garbage time, but it was like kind of after things were decided. And it was after the point where the Raptors had just sort of broken through. We're getting buckets all the way down the stretch, and the Warriors sort of. It was after that VanVleet shot where Steph is just like, nah, not today. We're not going to go all out here for the rest of it. And Clay, I guess the pressure was off, and he just started knocking down. I think he knocked down 2 or 3 3-pointers in that final stretch. But. And certainly the Raptors defense let up a little bit in those moments as well, which, you know, takes two to tango. But Clay has to be much better. And frankly, no one knows how to gauge what the hell to get from Clay on a minute by minute, hour by hour, game by game basis. Like it's not a knock. He lives life better than all of us. It seems like he's got it all figured out, and he certainly has a competitive fire that he doesn't get enough credit for.
But he has to play better. Like at the end of the day,
that's play better.
Like the Warriors Siakam need him to play better. Him. Yeah.
Pascal
might outplay him, but like the bigger issue is that like Fred VanVleet like can't approximate him. You know what I mean? Like that's the big thing. Yeah.
Sometimes we overanalyze this stuff. Like the best player on the floor was Pascal Siakam last night. Let's again just give Curry and Kawhi their credit, grandfather him in. Who was the fourth best player on the floor? I mean, it might have been Marc Gasol. Lowry did not have a good box score game. I thought he was super impactful. VanVleet, I'm waiting for the first Warrior to come to mind here because Draymond probably comes in after all of them, and Klay comes in after all. After
I mean,
Draymond.
Like Andre was useful. Andre was really good on defense last night, and he had 7 assists.
But Andre can't. Andre hasn't made a 3-pointer in 20 days. Like, and
fair point.
The Raptors are, as every team that has a brain should do, saying to Andre or, you know, Sean Livingston or Alphonso McKinney, but mostly Andre because he's playing the most minutes out of those guys, go ahead, shoot it. And the Houston Rockets dared him in Game 6 of the Western Conference semifinals, and he knocked down 5. And he hasn't made one since. And it didn't matter because the Blazers just weren't ready to go up against a Warriors team that was, geared up to run. But let's not forget that the Blazers had like 17-point leads in 3 of those games, and the Warriors just decided to turn it on and kind of got by. It was the closest sweep in NBA playoff history, something to that effect. I think the Warriors trailed for more than they led in that series, and yet they still swept. So it's not as if they're coming in as this hyper juggernaut. It was the formula for beating the Warriors has been there, and ultimately it requires the Warriors to beat themselves a little bit.
And it requires you to shoot at just like a ridiculously high level on it, like some point, right?
It requires you to make 62% of your contested shots to a certain degree. Yeah, I feel like the Warriors should feel pretty damn comfortable about where they're at going into this. If I hadn't seen this team's sort of championship medal manifest itself so many times just in this month, there would be viable reason to panic. I think that the X's and O's, the tactician in me looks at it and goes, oh shit, you know, this is going to be really tough for Golden State. But I kind of know that they got another gear and that they know how to tap into it.
So I think they have another gear. What I would do, I would start Andrew Bogut next game.
Yeah.
Play Kevon like the same number of minutes. You know, like Kevon played 28 last night. Like it's not like he didn't play. You know.
No. He was. I thought he was really damn good too. I mean, yeah, he wasn't a total game changer or anything, but like. You knew Kevon Looney was their best center last night.
Yeah, no question. Like, Kevon should get the lion's share of the
minutes. I don't even think they played Draymond at center last night. I don't think they played him at center for a minute.
No, I don't think they did either.
That's weird.
That is another thing that, like, I would probably do more of. And I understand why they're a little bit hesitant to do it, but...
Fuck it.
Yeah, I think that they're going to have to play more of these smaller lineups, mostly because...
Yeah.
Like... They're just getting hit too hard. If you need more speed on the court to be able to play this super, you know, help heavy, trap heavy defense where you're trying to take the ball out of certain guys' hands. And last night, it just felt like they didn't always have the recovery speed on the court to be able to do so.
And some of that is the rust that they were talking about, I'd have to imagine. But yeah, you're 100% right. It's weird that you don't play. Maybe it's not Bogut. I think it is Bogut. I think that you're right.
And well, maybe it is. Maybe it's Kevon is the starting center,
I'm telling you, they really like having Kevon off the bench because they're losing Andre Iguodala's intelligence off the bench, and they really like having that kind of calm head, that steady presence. Maybe they start Sean Livingston and Draymond at the five, though. I don't think that they'll be that bold.
McKinney?
McKinney would be a good option as well, though. I can't remember too many minutes where McKinney and that would kind of fuck up their rotations with Andre, because McKinney and Andre kind of have to swap one for the other. I can't remember too many minutes where they were on the court together, but I was kind of shocked that game had McKinney written all over it. And he has defensive liabilities that will just kind of make boneheaded plays every now and again. But
I thought he played like
three.
Fairly
he's a good
well,
player,
actually.
Yeah, I thought he was better than passable. And this series kind of has him written all over. This is going to be a wing-defined series in so many ways, especially when you look at the Raptors, of course.
Well, Andy knows the Raptors scheme well. Like, I mean, he's there.
I don't know if that means he can execute it, but, like, yeah.
He has a better feel for what's going to happen. Like, you would think he's going to
all these guys.
Like, you would think he'll fuck up less, basically.
Yes.
Just because he knows that scheme.
I feel like there's just so many different areas for experimentation that could lead to something better. And I don't think Bell played poorly again, but those need to be change-up minutes. That can't be your fastball. And if you want to, I agree with you, you got to go small, especially with Gasol just spending so much time beyond the three-point arc. Like, you're not really giving up that much in that regard. But yeah, maybe go with Bogut. Gives you some rim protection. The Raptors did feast at the rim, especially against in those Bell minutes early on. Maybe that clears some things up for you, and then you go small. But I would be shocked. I would be absolutely shocked if we don't see Draymond at the five for some stretch in game two. It was just kind of unconscionable to me that it didn't happen in game one. I'm still a bit flabbergasted. I refuse to acknowledge that it didn't happen.
All right, and the last point I want to make here, we've gone this entire podcast basically without bringing up Stephen Curry. Like, part of it is, I guess, that we take Steph for granted on some level, but we shouldn't do that. He was exceptional last night. He was the best player on the court last night. Like we can talk about Pascal, we can talk about Kawhi. Stephen Curry was the best player on the court last night. Like,
no question.
It was
like one point, he had like a 126 offensive rating or something. Like,
it was unbelievable. He was,
and a lot of those shots were tough.
Yeah, yeah, they were
He's a dude.
Yeah, he is. The way that he warps the game is just so ridiculous. Even against a great defense like Toronto, even against Kyle Lowry, who's a pretty good defender still, not quite what he was, but like
a tough motherfucker too.
And he's tough and he's strong. And Fred VanVleet is tough and he's strong and he fights over screens. Like,
yeah,
this was a very unbelievably good Stephen game. And I want to bring it up because, like, we haven't talked about Steph, and we really need to talk about Steph.
Well, because the Warriors wouldn't have stood half a chance of being in this game if Steph doesn't have a quasi-nuclear contest. And maybe that says more about the Raptors than it does about the Warriors. It's one of those things where I don't know. Like, maybe if the Warriors give him just a little bit more help, the entire game changes on that, just predicated on that small thing. Maybe this was a one-off and the Raptors can make the adjustment. I don't know. I'm fascinated to see because it's very clear, the obvious thing that we know, but it manifested in very clear terms last night, is it all revolves around Steph. And everyone on the Warriors knows it or not, but like, I'm fascinated to see how Toronto adjusts that. I'm fascinated to see how the Warriors try to help their guy out, because he carried him for, I don't know, all 48 minutes.
Yeah, and the Toronto adjustment is like nothing. Just do what you did again last night. And like part of that is unsustainable because you're probably not going to get 15 in unbelievable defense from Fred VanVleet again. You're probably not going to get 20-7 from Marc Gasol again. You're probably not going to get 32-8-5 from Pascal again.
No.
My bet is though that Kawhi doesn't shoot 5-14, but there's more room for downside than upside with Toronto. Like they played exceptionally well and I don't really think they should be changing much here.
That's my thing. Like the Warriors have a bunch of different things that they can tweak, and they don't have to do anything drastic, but there are tweaks that they can make. And now that they have the film, I trust their tactical ability to make those tweaks. I think that they actually kind of enjoy the chess match of it. They haven't been in too many of those. Even when they play the Rockets, which are always tough series, it's so rote and direct, and everyone kind of knows what the fuck is coming. It's not all that mentally stimulating. They haven't had one of these in quite a while. And I think that they're really enjoying this moment. It seemed like they were after the game last night. They're like, oh, man, this is fun. So they can make a bunch of little small adjustments and see what happens there. They can tinker, and maybe that shit backfires. But maybe it breaks through in some ways. Whereas the Raptors, like, if I'm Nick Nurse, I coached almost perfect game last night. I got an all-time performance from Pascal Siakam. I thought Kawhi was positive without shooting well. I'm not really he's going to do better. I'm not sure how much better. You want to run back the exact same game plan to a certain degree, knowing that it's unsustainable. And that's, again, where I think, man, if the Raptors had blown out the Warriors last night, as they probably should have, then we're probably having a much different conversation. But because the Warriors got this thing down to like 3 points, they got it down to one possession at one juncture in the fourth quarter. Like, and I just think about all the different little things that they can do just a bit better. And then the big thing that they can do a lot better, which is, you know, run on transition defense. I just have to think that the Warriors still have the upper hand in this bad boy. And oh yeah, if Kevin Durant does come back and this series is anything close, even if it's 2-1 Toronto, it's just an entirely different ballgame. Now, I don't know if the Warriors could go, you know, 3-1 from there, but I wouldn't bet against that.
All right. Dieter, tell the people where they can find what you're going to write about all of this series.
Oh, man, I got like a big honker up on the San Jose Mercury News and the East Bay Times website on last night and sort of all those things I just said. So you probably don't have to read it, but I'd appreciate it if you did. And I'm on Twitter at @dkurtenbach, which is mostly just me tweeting out interesting story links at this juncture, because Twitter is a cesspool.
Go subscribe to The Athletic. Go read Dieter's work. Go support all of the great stuff that's out there on the NBA Finals. We'll be back later after Game 2, probably. We'll talk about what's going on there. We'll talk about the NBA draft at some point with Cole coming up here. So got a lot of really fun stuff. But until next time, we'll talk soon.